The first question I wanted to ask you about, I just wondered, you know, what took you to Syria in the first place?
I mean, I don't know. There was no real plan to go to Syria. I'd studied international security and conflict studies in Dublin. And there were no kind of immediate jobs for graduates of that subject in Ireland, and I guess even in the UK as well. And I was interested in traveling that for quite a while. So in 2007, I left for Turkey and spent some time in Turkey and then moved on to Damascus. My kind of end goal was to move to Beirut, but things were a little bit, violent there at the time. And I didn't know much, didn't know anything about the country. And I had already spent a couple of weeks in Damascus. So I decided to kind of stay there and carve out some kind of a career as a journalist, because there were very few journalists in Syria in 2007. Mm-hmm. And I guess from that point of view, you know, there's a lot of things that could have been written about.
Mm-hmm. Had you been a journalist before you went to Syria?
I hadn't, no. I mean, I graduated from college, 6 months beforehand.
Oh, and literally just hopped right into it.
Basically, yeah.
Oh, wow. Okay, wow. And you were there for 5 years working freelance and also working for magazines?
Yeah, almost 5 years. I worked for a state newspaper called Syria Times for about 6 months in 2007, 2008 until that closed. And it's not really a newspaper. It's more of a propaganda kind of tool. It was an English language newspaper, and it wasn't very informative or anything. But it gave me a good insight into how the state system works there, and that. When that closed, I started doing some freelance work, feature articles and things like that. And then obviously when the revolution started, work came to me from all over the world, I suppose.
Yeah, I can imagine. I actually, that was sort of my next question. And when I was reading your book, which I enjoyed, it seemed like there were several times, you know, right when things are getting started, that life got really sort of surreal and bizarre. And you had one section, I'll just read it to you, I loved it. It was, a foreboding atmosphere took over the city during these weeks in an outpouring of pro-Assad indulgence not seen in the country for decades. It was frankly frightening to see people I knew and thought of as friends for years behaving in such a way. I just wonder if you could talk a little bit about what life was like when the uprising started.
Yeah. I mean, those demonstrations were frankly the strangest things I've ever seen, I think. Just from nowhere, you had this massive outpouring of kind of declarations in support of the president. It was completely bizarre. It was like a scene from a TV, a movie or something like that. And it was entirely state-sponsored. I mean, people did come and so on, but mostly they were state employees who had been bused to these demonstrations in the capital, in Damascus. But it was just really astounding to see this kind of state-dominated, forcibly kind of movement, to in support of the president. And a lot of people didn't really know why. I mean, they knew things were happening in Daraa in the early days, but they weren't quite sure why there was this massive kind of reaction in support of the president. And it was strange for me, and strange that they were a lot of Syrians to try and figure out or understand the relationship between what was happening in Daraa and why there was this outpouring of support for the president. You know, it was less than subtle. And it was clear, obviously, from that, I suppose, that it was very much state-sponsored and organized by the government.
Yeah, you had that one. There was some section where a bunch of photos of the president went up all in one day, and then they all came down or something on the same day.
That's right, yeah, for about a week, I think, or maybe a bit less. Maybe it was a day, I'm not quite sure. But, yeah, every single public transport, bus and micro, and the majority of taxis had pictures of the president and slogans supporting the government and so on. Then I think it was a Saturday, I recall, I was going back into Damascus. I lived outside Damascus, actually. And they were all gone, kind of uniformly gone from the micros on the streets and on the highways. So, I mean, for me, that kind of raised some questions in that, where people kind of kind of forced to have these posters up on their taxis and buses, which would impression that there wasn't this genuine support for the president, because it's very hard. I mean, I couldn't go to people, the taxi drivers and vehicle drivers, and say, you know, do you actually support the president? You couldn't do that.
Mm.
It wasn't a possibility. It wasn't safe. You know, you were putting yourself in harm's way even. And, you know, yeah, I mean, that day when they all came down, it gave me good insight into, I guess, just how state-centered this whole kind of pro kind of Bashar sentiment was. You know, it was very much top-down.
And as time went on, it seemed like there are a couple of times, you know, like later in the book, where friends and sources that you had for years, like, started to surprise you with the things that they were saying. You seemed sort of, you know, taken aback a bit sometimes. Did that happen quite a bit, where you were surprised? You felt like maybe you didn't know the people that you had thought you knew?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, the state media is very, very... I'm not sure if influential is the right word, but it's everywhere, you know. I mean, all the radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, everywhere you look in the streets, there's posters of the president and, you know, saying how good he is and everything and how important he is for the country. I mean, at the beginning of the revolution, there was a lot of people started to openly talk about, among their friends, you know, not with strangers. I think it's important to point out that differentiation. A lot of people did start talking about politics and what should happen to the country and where it should go, and, you know, a lot of people, especially in Damascus, are saying at that time that the regime is talking about enacting reforms and that let's give them a chance, and even, you know, to talk about things like that was kind of almost unheard of before the revolution started. So you had this opening up of kind of conversation in that about politics and the state and so on. I guess a few months into the revolution, the talking kind of stopped because people had kind of set their opinions out, and it was either, you know, people were either kind of pro or against, and there was very little space in the middle. And, you know, when people had laid out their point of view and if people opposed it, there was no more talking to do about it. You know, people would just argue and that would be it. So, you know, that opening up of free speech kind of, I guess, kind of not ended, but it certainly subdued it a lot, because people didn't want to listen to people, you know, their friends or colleagues or acquaintances who had opposing opinions on, you know, who was responsible for the revolution and what should happen to the country.
Mm. So it's almost like it wasn't like... people were afraid of how it was almost like everyone got out what they wanted to say, and then it came to a point where everyone was pretty clear about what they were saying, and there was no point maybe in saying it anymore, it sounds like.
Yeah, it was, I mean, in a sense, I don't know, people, a lot of blame was being cast around.
Mm.
For some reason, people don't like to listen to opposing opinions. You know, it's kind of people who supported the revolution would hang out with and speak to other friends who supported the revolution. And similarly, for people who supported the regime, they had very little time for people who backed the revolt. And it was, I mean, it's kind of sad, I guess, that there isn't this dialogue on a kind of widespread level anymore.
Mm.
Between pro and against, or, you know, what should happen to the country. It's become much more solidified. And, you know, it's unfortunate.
I wanted to ask you about that, because it seems pretty clear from, you know, from the book and from your article in Foreign Policy that you feel that things are much more complicated than the media is reporting. You know, you said something at the end of your Foreign Policy piece about now it's Syrians killing Syrians, but reading the news you might never know. And I think Bassem Haddad said something a little bit like that on PBS the other night. And I just wondered if you could maybe reflect a bit on why, you know, why those shades of gray are missing from the reporting. Is it an access issue, or is it a misread of what's happening in Syria? What is it?
Yeah, I guess it's a number of different factors. There's only so much a 5-minute TV news piece can say about Syria, and it's obviously a very complicated place. The controls on access to the country for journalists is definitely an issue too. But at the same time, journalists are being allowed in through the official channels. But, I mean, yeah, I mean, it's different. I mean, you can't simply say that all Sunnis oppose the regime, and that all minorities, which make up about 25% of the population, support the government. It's just not that black and white. And it's important, I think, to point that out because, you know, when other countries around the world make kind of policy decisions about what they're going to do about Syria, certainly it's important in terms of whether, you know, military intervention is going to take place, direct military intervention. You know, such decisions are based on assumptions that this kind of set of people will support, you know, the rebellion and what kind of military intervention comes, I guess. It's very clear, I think, what's happening in Aleppo at the moment, because there hasn't, there certainly doesn't seem to be, obviously I haven't been there now, so it's difficult for me to say, but there hasn't been this kind of ground support of, you know, among families and people in the city for the rebels and what they're doing. I mean, you had demonstrations for months and months in Aleppo, but there's very little support, it seems, for the actual violent kind of conflict and what the rebels are trying to do. You know, people want peace, like anywhere. People want peace and stability and that. And when they see the rebels coming, they know the regime is going to react in a very violent way. And, you know, inevitably it's the civilians who suffer. So I guess from that perspective, the FSA hasn't done, whatever we want to call the rebels, it hasn't done a very good job in its kind of public relations to try and, I don't know, to convince civilians that they're working for them. So, you know, that's another aspect of why it's very complicated. You have protesters who want the regime out, but they don't want to resort to violence. And you have rebels who are using guns and weapons to fight the government. And all at the same time, you have this kind of regime propaganda saying that it's foreign forces who are trying to, you know, disturb the country. So it's, I mean, you know, it's a very complicated situation. I could talk about it for hours, I guess.
Yeah, no, it just seems like it often gets simplified, you know, opposition versus regime, when it seems like there's many oppositions. And actually, I wanted to ask you about that too. From inside Syria, I don't know when you exactly left, but I'd be curious to know your impression of the opposition from within. If it's still LCCs or LLCs, and or if it's, you know, sort of small local networks, or how it works exactly.
Yeah, I left in mid-February, and certainly at that time there was very, very little respect and support for the traditional opposition groups, I guess the Syrian National Council and other opposition figures who were based outside the country. These are the guys who appeared on Al Jazeera and Al Arabiya kind of every evening, kind of denouncing the government and saying that the opposition needs arms and money and so on. Inside the country, there was very little support for these guys because they were safe and you know, the security and so on, being in Cairo or being in Istanbul, the regime couldn't come and get them. Mm-hmm. And they didn't succeed in what they were trying to do, which was to get international military support. So from the, you know, the point of view of the protesters and I guess the Free Army or whatever you want to call these rebels, they have very little respect for the international, the opposition that's based overseas. Yeah, speaking of the local coordinating committees, I think they're very important. I think they will be very important in the future in a post-Assad Syria, because they already have the contacts on the ground. They have a very kind of wide network of activists and that. And when it comes to some stage, we don't know when it comes to the point of elections, hopefully, and referendums and so on, these guys already have a support system in place, and they have contacts in every town and village and neighborhood in the country. So I think these LCC committees will be very important in the future.
And do they work in coordination with the FSA, or are they a completely separate entity, or in some places are they connected and other places not? How does it work?
Yeah, I think in some places they're connected. I think they exchange intelligence and so on. But I think, for the most part, I mean, the goal is the same. They both want the regime to fall. The method of doing that differs quite a bit, it seems. I mean, the LCCs began out of these peaceful protests, where people, you know, after prayers, they would come out of the mosques and call for the downfall of the regime. They weren't picking up guns. So they're kind of, at their core, they're a peaceful movement. The FSA is something very different. You know, it's bands of rebels around the country who are doing what they can to get the regime to fall, I suppose. So from, you know, from the kind of objective point, you know, from an their objectives perspective, they're quite different. I mean, the LCCs are essentially peaceful. The rebels are not, for the most part. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I guess essentially they want the same thing, but the way to achieve it is quite different.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. You know, I don't know if you've had a chance to read the ICG report released last week, but they, you know, in the end of it, they were suggesting that Syria's future is largely dependent on the fate of the Alawites. They said, I'll just quote it, toppling the regime means going to war with the Alawite community, and going to war with the Alawite community means the end of a united pluralistic Syria. And the end of the report really asks, what will the opposition or oppositions do about the increasing sectarian killings, and how will it ensure that the transition includes Alawites' full-fledged partners? And I wonder, you know, just talking about the LCCs and the FSA, do you agree with this kind of narrative that ICG is seeing, and do you think that these different groups kind of have a plan for the next day, if and when the regime is toppled?
I mean, usually the ICG reports are very good. I'm not sure the opposition has a plan for the day after. They seem to be extremely inept in what they're trying to do. I mean, the longer the regime stays, the more likely there will be a sustained kind of civil war that could go on for years, because the longer the regime stays, the more the violence grows, the more number of people die, and the more opportunities or possibilities, I suppose, for retribution, you know, they increase it as well. But I think, you know, it's difficult to say, because the regime has been rather, I think it surprised a lot of people, including myself, in its durability. I think once the regime falls, that there won't be a civil war, because I don't think Alawites have enough numbers to sustain a civil war against the kind of, I guess, a Sunni-led transitional authority or government. Alawites are the only people that we can expect to try and continue a conflict. And they're not, you know, the demographics don't add up. They don't have majority populations in any cities in Syria. Even on the coast, there are minorities. You know, except for the villages, I guess, in the mountains, which are mostly, you know, on the coastal mountains, they're mostly kind of Alawi dominated in that. But, you know, they're isolated, and there's very few. I mean, I can't see Alawis inviting violence into their own villages and that. You know, but obviously, the more people who die, the more possibilities there will be for a kind of civil war, kind of continuing after the government falls, and kind of tit for tat kind of killings and that. There will be retributions and so on between families, kind of particularly, I think, where you have you know, Sunni villages close to Alawi villages and that. That will happen, but I don't think there will be a kind of full-scale civil war, but that's based on the fact that the regime falls in the kind of relative near future.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you raise an interesting point about you know, whether the Alawis would rise up in a full-scale civil war, and I guess one thing that I got from your writing, from both, you know, the article and the book, I mean, you have a lot of articles, but the foreign policy one, it just was the sense that people, especially in the beginning, were going into the streets not based on any, obviously on any sort of sectarian thing, but on because they'd been personally affected by the regime. You had a section where you're talking about how the people went out, you know, they weren't part of an opposition, they weren't trying to bring democracy, they just went out because they had been lost a son or a father or a brother. And it just seems like there's a silent majority in there somewhere in Syria that's, you know, not necessarily with any parties or following along because they're worried about their safety as a sect or whatever, but they're maybe silently sort of waiting things out.
Yeah, I mean, there's two issues there. I mean, for every individual who dies in Syria, overnight you have, whether they be pro-regime or rebels or demonstrators, you know, for every person who dies overnight, you have dozens of people in terms of family and friends who have become more in support of the opposition or more in support of the government and more hardline in their views and more militarized in some respects, I guess. You know, so from that point of view, you know, the more people who die, the more difficult it's going to be to kind of reconstruct the country in that. The second part of your question is just what is it that slipped my mind?
I guess I can't even remember it myself, but it was just I'm just curious whether you know there. I guess it sounds like you're saying there are incentives as time goes on, and as you know people become more personally affected, there's incentives for people to take a side. Really, is that kind of what you're saying?
Yeah. I mean that's essentially it. I don't think we can compare Syria to Iraq or Lebanon. You know, I mean, it's the demographic numbers don't add up because it's just 10% of the population, as I say, who are Alawis and can be maybe expected to continue a fight. I don't think Christians are going to take up arms for the remnants of Bashar's regime. You know, they've done rather well, but it's a big difference between being supportive and taking up guns and that. So. You know, from that point of view, it seems, I think at least, that in the long term, that long-term violent conflict, or even, you know, what happened in Lebanon and Iraq, I don't think it's as likely to happen in Syria.
Mm. Excuse me. I'm curious to know what you make of the recent defections. Do they make a difference?
They make some difference, but not as much, I think, as we're kind of led to believe in maybe some of the mainstream media. You know, I mean, the prime minister, it's largely, certainly in this time of war for the regime, it's largely a ceremonial post, and they can bring in ministers all day and long. I mean, there's two kind of entities I think we need to distinguish between. One is the regime and one is the government. The regime is kind of the family and the people who are involved with and in charge of the security and the military. The government then are all the government positions and ministries and that, where people come and go in their positions. You know, every couple of years, maybe you have a new minister for whatever ministry. So, you know, the regime itself is something a little bit different, and the people inside the regime are very important. I think ministers, not so much. But, you know, it's good for morale, I guess, for the opposition and the Free Army when they hear prime ministers defecting and that.
Mm-hmm. Is it true that he was still in Deraa when they made the announcement in Amman? Have you seen that?
It's possible. I'm not sure. Two other ministers were supposed to defect with him, and apparently, I'm not sure. Maybe they were caught. I think the finance minister was supposed to go as well, but I think he was caught in progress. I don't know. I can't say. But it was facilitated from the inside, and it, apparently, kind of before he was even given the post, he had planned or was looking to leave the country.
Interesting. I'm curious also what you make of the international involvement. You know, obviously China and Russia on one hand, Qatar and Saudi Arabia on the other, and then Obama's signed the intelligence order to support the FSA, William Hague's announcement today about the 5 million non-lethal assistance. I mean, do you think, do these actions from the outside tip a balance, or are they just prolonging fighting?
They don't tip any balance, I think. They give an advantage to the Free Army and the rebels, but the Free Army and the rebels need anti-tank weapons, and they need anti-aircraft guns, and they need hard, heavy-duty kind of military equipment, you know, if they want to defeat the regime in the kind of near or short or medium term, I guess. You know, I guess it's symbolic more than anything else, what the international community is doing. But I'd be slow to kind of say that on one side it's Saudi Arabia and Qatar and Turkey, and you know, on the other side it's kind of supporting the regime of Iran and Hezbollah. I don't think Syrians themselves would accept a very kind of pro or leaning government that leans towards what Saudi Arabia wants. There's a heavy kind of, or a healthy even, distrust of Saudi Arabia among Syrians in the country. And I don't think, I'd be skeptical to think that Saudi Arabia, if, you know, when the regime falls even, that Saudi Arabia would have significant control over whatever government that follows. I think a lot of people have died in Syria. I think they would be very slow to give up their country and give up their governments based on other countries' desires and wishes. So, yeah, I mean, you know, playing up this idea that it's these kind of, it's a proxy war. Certainly other countries are influencing what's happening. That's quite obvious. But I think, you know, in the post-Assad kind of situation, Syrians have lost a lot, and they're going to want to keep the country for themselves when and how they can.
And what do you think of Alakzar Brahimi? Do you think he can pull through where Kofi Annan failed, or do you think it's the UN mission at this point is meaningful at all?
No, I don't think there's an individual on the planet who could succeed in that position.
Mm-hmm.
The regime has absolutely no interest in playing ball in following a diplomatic solution. It says it is, and it always plays up how important Kofi Annan's plan is and so on. But that's it's a total charade. It's cover for them while they continue to pound parts of Aleppo or parts of Homs or Idlib or wherever. On one hand, just saying they're working with the Kofi Annan's plan and partaking in it, but in reality, it's very different. It doesn't matter who's leading any group. I think it's a waste of time. I guess it's the international community can put their hands up and say, look, well, we're trying to do something, but it's largely symbolic, and the regime has no interest in peace, in any kind of transition kind of government situation.
And you were in Beirut recently, weren't you?
Yeah.
I'm curious what the mood is in Beirut over, if you could notice anything or if you...
Yeah, I spent some time with... Syrian Palestinians from Damascus who had to flee because of the violence and the fighting there last week and the week before, and you know, they're in an awful situation because they're trying to, you know, they don't have passports, they can't travel easily. I think Lebanon is the only place that they can get to kind of have, you know, temporary kind of visa situation or agreement, I think. And they've left the country with, like other refugees, I guess, they've left the country with very little, and they have very little money, and they don't know when they can go back, and so on. You know, it depends who you, in terms of Lebanese, it depends who you speak to. If you speak to landlords, they're quite happy that there's lots of Syrian refugees, especially the middle class, the Messines, who kind of went over to Beirut the last couple of weeks. A lot of them have gone back now. But a lot of the Messines have continued to rent apartments and that. And they have, you know, they're providing money, I guess, to landlords and so on. The Gulf, people from the Gulf who traditionally usually kind of came to Lebanon to holiday didn't come this year.
Mm.
So I guess the wealthy Messines are picking up the slack a little bit. It's very different. I mean, you can walk down the main streets in Beirut and... you can hear the Syrian accents of people kind of begging for money and that on the streets. So it depends, you know. I mean, you know, lots of Lebanese are not happy because it's driven up the price of housing and that. But if you happen to own a set of apartments or an apartment block, I guess they're rather happy that there are Syrians coming over.
Interesting. And then the last question, curious what your next move is. You're going to Toronto?
Yeah, hopefully, yeah. Visa pending to do a fellowship in global journalism at the Monk School of Global Affairs in Toronto, at the University of Toronto. So that's planned for 8 months from next month, hopefully.
Do you think you might go back into Syria at some point?
Yeah, I certainly hope to, yeah. I think once the regime falls or shortly after, I'd like to go back. I don't know. I'm not sure for how long, but it's definitely somewhere I want to go back to and kind of figure out what's happening, you know. It's a very interesting country, and I couldn't do all these kind of the scenario kind of stories in that. I couldn't travel around the country as I wished because of this security system hanging over my head. And when the regime falls, I hope that it would be easier to travel around and that people would speak more freely and so on, and, you know, try and get to understand the country a bit better.
Excellent. Well, thank you for taking the time to answer all these questions, and we're really looking forward to having you at the conference.